your senses.
At least show it to Ronnie. Ronald Sumner Lloyd was Julian's pricey Berkeley Square attorney.
I have a better idea,
he said. It was then at 11:36 a.m., with Sarah looking on in disapproval, that Julian dangled the letter over his ancient metal dustbin, a relic of the gallery's glory days when it was located on stylish New Bond Street, or New Bond Strasse, as it had been known in some quarters of the trade. Try as he might, he couldn't seem to let the damn thing slip from his fingers. Or perhaps, he thought later, it was Madame Berengar's letter that had clung to him. He set it aside, reviewed the remainder of the Morning Post, returned a few phone calls, and interrogated Sarah on the details of a pending sale. Then, having nothing else to do, he headed off to the Dorchester for lunch. He was accompanied by an employee of a venerable London auction house, female, of course, recently divorced, no children, far too young, but not inappropriately so. Julian astonished her with his knowledge of Italian and Dutch Renaissance painters and regaled her with tales of acquisitional derring-do. It was a character he had been playing to modest acclaim for longer than he cared to remember. He was the incomparable Julian Isherwood, Julie to his friends, juicy Julie to his partners in the occasional crime of drink. He was loyal as the day was long, trusting to a fault, and English to the core. English as high tea and bad teeth, as he was fond of saying. And yet, were it not for the war, he would have been someone else entirely. Returning to the gallery, he found that Sarah had adhered a fuchsia-colored sticky note to Madame Berengar's letter, advising him to reconsider. He read it a second time, slowly. Its tone was as formal as the linen-like stationery upon which it was written. Even Julian had to admit she sounded entirely reasonable and not at all like an extortionist. Surely, he thought, there would be no harm in merely listening to what she had to say. If nothing else, the journey would provide him with a much-needed respite from his crushing workload at the gallery. Besides, the weather forecast for London called for several days of nearly uninterrupted cold and rain. But in the southwest of France, it was springtime already. Among the first actions that Sarah had taken after coming to work at the gallery was to inform Ella, Julian's stunning but useless receptionist, that her services were no longer required. Sarah had never bothered to hire a replacement. She was more than capable, she said, of answering the phone, returning the emails, keeping the appointment book, and buzzing visitors upstairs when they presented themselves at the perpetually locked door in Mason's Yard. She drew a line, however, at making Julian's travel arrangements, though she consented to peer over his shoulder while he performed the chore himself, if only to make certain he didn't mistakenly book passage on the Orient Express to Istanbul, rather than the Eurostar to Paris. From there, it was a scant 2 hours and 14 minutes by TGV to Bordeaux. He successfully purchased a first-class ticket and then reserved a junior suite at the Intercontinental, for 2 nights, just to be on the safe side. The task complete, he repaired to the bar at Wilton's for a drink with Oliver Dimbleby and Roddy Hutchinson, widely regarded as London's most disreputable art dealers. One thing led to another, as was usually the case when Oliver and Roddy were involved, and it was after 2 a.m. by the time Julian finally toppled into his bed. He spent Saturday tending to his hangover, and devoted much of Sunday to packing a bag. Once he would have thought nothing about hopping on the Concorde with only an attaché case and a pretty girl. But suddenly the preparations for a jaunt across the English Channel required all of his powers of concentration. He supposed it was but another unwanted consequence of growing old, like his alarming absent-mindedness, or the strange sounds he emitted, or his seeming inability to cross a room without crashing into something. He kept a list of self-deprecating excuses at the ready to explain his humiliating clumsiness. He had never been the athletic type. It was the bloody lamp's fault. It was the end table that had assaulted him. He slept poorly, as was frequently the case the night before an important journey, and awoke with a nagging sensation that he was about to make yet another in a long series of dreadful mistakes. His spirits lifted, however, as the Eurostar emerged from the Channel Tunnel and surged across the grey-green fields of the Pas-de-Calais toward Paris. He rode the métro from the Gare du Nord to the Gare Montparnasse and enjoyed a decent lunch in the buffet car of the TGV as the light beyond his window gradually took on the quality of a Cézanne landscape. He recalled with startling clarity the instant he had seen it for the first time. This